This is Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we'll be talking Obsession with British actor Idris Elba. And no, that's nothing to do with fans of The Wire, but his new film, Obsessed, starring Idris alongside Beyoncé Knowles. Director Gideon Koppel explores another kind of obsession, the love of his childhood home in Wales, in his debut feature, Sleep Furiously, a poetic evocation that's won fans from Tilda Swinton to John Malkovich, and he can add Film Weekly to that list. Zan Brooks will be joining me to review Obsessed, Fugitive Pieces, and Sam Raimi's return to the horror genre, Drag Me to Hell. Yes, it's the show that just won't let go, Film Weekly. Idris Elba joins that growing and honourable list of British actors who've made it on US TV before breaking into Hollywood and finding themselves on the A-list back here. Idris made his sizeable reputation with his role as Stringer Bell, the brains behind the brawn in cult series The Wire, and since then he's been a very busy man indeed. This week sees him starring alongside Beyoncé Knowles and Heroes star Ali Larter in Obsessed, a tale of a good man driven to the brink by the amorous obsession of a stalker in his office. I spoke to Idris about his role in Obsessed, but first let's hear him in action as the maligned Derek trying to appease his wife Sharon, played by a very, very angry Beyoncé Knowles.
I don't know what to believe right now. Okay. I think I need to be alone.
No.
I need Sharon to be alone.
Stop, Derek. Okay? Come on. Sharon, please. Sharon, come on.
Get out of my house!
This is crazy, Sharon! Don't you see what's happening?
Get out of my house.
Nothing happened with this. Okay, you know what? You just tell me what you want me to do, and that's what I'll do. Huh?
Well, first, I suggest you pack your toothbrush. And then I want you to get your socks, your shaving kit, your underwear, your prophylactics if you think you need them, and get your ass
and
out of
here. And go where, Sharon?
To hell!
And joining me on the line now is Idris Elba, who's in Glasgow, of all places. What are you doing up there, Idris?
I'm shooting a film.
And that's Legacy, is it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And what do you play in that?
It's about a soldier, schizophrenia. He comes back from the detail and comes back to try and deal with that. And he has some family issues. It's kind of hard to sort of break it down.
Right. Is it a British film?
It's, in a sense, it is, but it's about an American soldier.
Okay.
So it's actually a British film, British director.
Because, I mean, we hear you now, and obviously you sound like you've got your Hackney voice on, and it's lovely to hear you again. But I think most people will be surprised now when they hear you, because you've been doing Baltimore so wonderfully in The Wire, which is now just taking off and to become one of the classic TV series of all time, Idris. It must be amazing to be associated with that. I mean, I know you've done London's Burning, and that's big too. But The Wire is something else.
London's Burning, that's funny. The Wire was a very special show. It's very special. I'm glad that the UK is starting, getting a chance to sort of view it. It's great.
Because, I mean, this week you're on the big screen, obviously, in Obsessed, with a huge star opposite Beyoncé Knowles, which is must be wonderful. I know she's in the UK as well, obviously, touring now. This is the film in which she kind of displays her both sides, the lovely Beyoncé side and her Sasha Fierce kind of kick-ass side, and you get the full brunt of it, mate, as her husband. What was it like working with her?
It was great. It was a very sort of normal process in terms that she's very much an actress. She wasn't sort of Beyoncé the pop star as we know her, but she was very much an actress. It's a very human story. So, making the film was very sort of like tense and intense. A lot of drama between her and myself and Ali Larter, and it was good fun, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah, because I mean, it's a big part for you as Derek, this kind of a crucial kind of maligned male part in the middle of it, who's kind of torn between kind of sexuality and the home front. It's a kind of turmoil that you did very well, if I may say.
Thank you.
It's kind of an important part. We don't get to see this sort of part very much. I mean, I kind of mentioned that it kind of reminded me of Michael Douglas a bit in Fatal Attraction and a bit in Disclosure as well.
It was great for me to play that part. I sort of don't get to do big films like that, and it was obviously a big Hollywood film.
That's right. I mean, I see you working with Beyoncé, and I know it went to number one in the States, meaning that she can open a big movie, you can open in a big movie. That's great to know in terms of Hollywood numbers, that these things work for you, isn't it? It must be a right thrill.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't expecting its success. Interestingly enough, the stats have come in that, people went to see the film more about the subject than for either myself or Beyoncé or Ali. It was more about the subject matter, the poster, the idea that there was this sort of you know, triangle going on between these three characters that were on the poster. And I think when people get to the theater, that's what they get. You know, it could suggest a whole lot of things. You know, there's an African American couple,
that's
you know,
right,
and a white girl on the cover, and you're like, oh, I wonder what that's about. And your mind wants to think about, you know, the race issue and all kind of stuff, but it doesn't happen. You know, it's more of a thriller, and it's kind of more representation of what's going on today.
Yeah, because, you know? I mean, there's the racial politics and the sexual politics as well mixed up. And the racial politics aren't really dealt with. They're there, as you say, on the poster, and you're kind of aware of it. I think the more mature approach is to be less hysterical about it, isn't it? And just sort of say, well, look, you know, they happen to be an African-American couple doing really well for themselves. We call them buppies, I think, in Hollywood. And then they're kind of disbalanced by this kind of white girl. But it never gets to that level in the film.
But yeah, it doesn't. But the fact that she's white and you know, we're black has nothing to do with the story. You know, it's called Obsessed because this one person gets obsessed with another person. So, you know, I think, and that's refreshing. The fact that, you know, it's multicast. You know, it's a multi-ethnic cast, and it's refreshing that, you know, it has the race has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder. I did mention London's Burning a bit cheekily earlier there, Idris, and I could have mentioned.
I noticed that.
I could have mentioned Ruth Rendell, AbFab, 2.4 children, even.
Crime Watch.
Crime Watch, exactly. Crime Watch, which I thought you were fantastic in. But it just kind of. I wonder what the difference it is that you had to leave the UK to go and do this wonderful kind of career that is now opening up for you in Hollywood. Is it actually difficult? Is it with hard heart that you actually kind of think, oh, I do have to leave to do this? Or is it just a natural progression and you go where the work is?
I think it's natural more than anything. I mean, I've managed to sort of maintain a sort of relationship with the industry here and just England in general. You know, I'm English. My parents live here. My family's here. My friends are here. So I maintain a sort of relationship. But, you know, my industry, you know, there's a sort of like, there's a glass ceiling of thing, you know. There's a glass ceiling in America, but it's set higher. You know, you can only go so far in this world, you know. There's only so much room for so many stars. And I guess when I was sort of like in the, I think it was the mid-90s when I left, I was sort of like, you know, I really want to do more. I want to, you know, I was doing a lot of TV work and it was great. I wasn't sort of not working, I was working, but I just wanted, you know, my ambition wanted, you know, a larger house to grow in, and the States was the answer.
And what was the moment for you? Is it The Wire that you think is going to be the one that kind of launches you? Because, I mean, I remember seeing you in American Gangster with Denzel, a great part for you and a great kind of opportunity for you. Obviously working with the British director, Ridley Scott. When was when you say, you know what, this is really working, this move has paid off, you know?
Honestly, I just got asked to take part in a remake of, it's actually not a remake, but it's the movie version of Play School, where I will be playing Bungle. And I mean, you've made it when you get asked to play Bungle. I mean, let's just be honest. So that's, you know, that's, I know now I'm destined for the BAFTA once I get that.
Yeah, well, you have our full support here at Film Weekly. Mate, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly and good luck.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Well, like Idris Elba, I feel stalked myself. My colleague Zan Brooks chased me all the way to Cannes and back again. I cannot shake him. He joins me in the pod yet again. Welcome back, Zan. A nice Cannes?
Oh, it was a great Cannes. I kind of miss it already.
Yeah, I do too.
Can we go back?
Yeah, I think it would be nice to, wouldn't it? Because, like, I mean, we'll talk about the films we're going to review this week. We're going to do Obsessed with Idris Elba, do Fugitive Pieces with Rosamund
Pike. Yeah, that's why I want to go back.
Yeah, exactly. And Drag Me to Hell, which was
at Cannes.
Featured at Cannes. But let's just round up those Cannes results, because the last time we podded, which was from Cannes, we managed to get in the last film I think we managed to review was the Michael Haneke film, which we said was a monumental masterpiece. And there it went. It went and won the Palme d'Or for Michael Haneke. So well done him for the White Ribbon. Deserved winner?
I think so. I think it was the strongest film in competition, and it was a sort of significant, substantial film, and I think we were immediately aware of that when we were watching it. I don't even think it was my personal favourite from the festival. You know, I think I preferred the Odiar and Prophet, but I think it was a deserved winner, and he should have maybe won it 3 years ago, 4 years ago for Hidden.
For Hidden, yeah, and then the piano teacher, I think, won the Best Actress and Best Actor, and he won Best Screenplay.
But I think that The White Ribbon is better than those films. I think that generally the prizes went to the right films this year's festival.
Yeah, I think so. Let's talk about the Actor and Actress Awards, which are never the sort of biggest things in Cannes, but the world actually sort of takes notes of them. Best Actor went to Christoph Waltz, who is
I'm kind of pleased about that.
Yeah, me too.
This is like a middle-aged German actor who's been in soaps, I think, on German TV, always playing a doctor. I kind of looked on IMDb and he always seems to be playing a doctor. And in the Tarantino film, he gives a really wonderfully over-the-top performance, but over-the-top in exactly the right way as the sort of the chief Nazi. And it was a superb kind of scene-stealing performance. He completely like wipes the floor with Brad Pitt.
With everyone,
film.
Yeah. Because he speaks German, French, English beautifully, and I just thought it was a really gifted show. Tarantino does this. I remember watching Jackie Brown and not being knowing who Robert Forster was. And of course, Tarantino kind of finds these little gems, and he's really, I think that's probably the best thing about Inglourious Basterds.
I think it is.
Performance.
Yeah. And so I was very pleased to see him. Best Actress going to Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Yeah, your mate.
My mate, I think, has annoyed people because most people were so annoyed by the film that they really didn't want it to win anything. Maybe it's not, you know, technically a great performance, but it's certainly a brave performance.
Definitely.
And
I mean, it's a
bold performance.
Running around
and
naked performance.
Certainly attention grabbing. So and as someone who did like Antichrist, I was glad to see it rewarded.
And just some latest news, that Andrew Arnold's film Fish Tank will be, you can see it at the Edinburgh Festival, that's where it makes it UK premiere, and the Michael Haneke, I think, is headed towards the London Film Festival, so you might have to wait till October, late October, to see that. It's a bit of festival news to catch up on then. But Zan, as you said, we're back here in Great Britain. We are back here in the UK releases, and the first film we went to see after Cannes was the film Obsessed. Zan, as I said, a very different film to one we usually get in Cannes. I hadn't seen a film like this for quite a long time.
That's a good thing, though, Jason. And here it comes. I thought this was kind of trashy. Kind
it
of
is
rubbish.
Very trashy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it trashy enough to be fun?
No, it wasn't for me.
I quite enjoyed
no,
it.
No, I really didn't. I really didn't. And I like Idris Elba a lot.
Yeah, he's cool.
Can I guess this is that weird, awkward transition film where you're going from an acclaimed HBO series to the deeper waters of the Hollywood blockbuster or Hollywood thriller. And this maybe isn't the best first step.
So, I mean, he's got a big hulking presence in this. And quite a nice, buppy kind of role in this one. Good to see black characters given the kind of big house and big job and big money.
Yeah, there was interesting sort of racial politics here. And I think the script was written by the guy who did Lakeview Terrace, which was a film that made a great play of those issues.
That's right.
This film doesn't explore that at all.
No, it's not there, I mean, but not there.
It's there, but just not explored in the slightest. And so it felt like a bit of a sort of distraction, really. Beyoncé Knowles has very little to do until the sort of the final scene.
I mean, there's a note, I'm looking at my notes, there's a note saying, why did Beyoncé take this role?
Well,
then
she takes it, I guess, for the big cat fight at the end of the film.
Yeah, when she moves from Beyoncé Knowles into Sasha Fierce.
Also, the thing about the cat fight at the end is that you know, you've got Beyoncé Knowles, who's very beautiful and kind of strapping, against Ali Larter, who's a little slip of a thing, and you think, there's really going to be only one winner here.
Beyoncé on tour in the UK at the moment. I don't know if she does that, just throwing skinny-ass white girls around the stage. That's Obsessed, Zan. Let's move on to a rather differently paced film, Fugitive Pieces, based on the Orange Prize-winning novel by E.M. Michaels. A beautiful piece about the survivors of a Holocaust, starring Rosamund Pike and Stephen Delane. It has fragments of the Holocaust trickling on into modern life.
And there was this Czech woman, a farmer's wife.
Mm-hmm.
She had a family of Jews. People she barely even knew. Seven of them for the entire war.
Almost 2 years.
Feeding them. At the end of the war was the first time her husband found out about it. Just a sec. You think he'd be proud of her, yes?
Sure.
He beat her so badly she almost died.
Jake, maybe you should just give Maurice a break.
No, it's okay.
No, it's not. You're not married to him. You're not obligated to listen to this stuff 24 hours a day.
Alex, really, it's...
No, Maurice, it makes your brain explode. His obsession with these details...
Alex.
It's obscene.
Stan, Fugitive Pieces. It was a beautiful novel. I don't know if you read it.
I hadn't read it.
Yeah, no, I mentioned this because it's one of the rare books I have read. So, yeah, I got a bit lucky this week. I know it is a beautiful book. The film, do you think it kind of feels like a book?
Totally felt like a book. It felt like a very tentative, respectful adaptation of a great novel where they were a little bit nervous of it.
Yeah.
And were kind of circling it. And obviously, it's a very poetic novel. It's a kind of elliptical novel.
That's exactly right.
It's not a pulp thriller that you can kind of find a clean line.
It's not the Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah,
of
and
novels.
there's that old Hollywood maxim that bad books make good films and good books make bad films. That's probably a little harsh because I thought that there was some good stuff in here. I like Stephen Delane as an actor as the damaged soul who's kind of looking back into his past. And I liked the elegant use of flashbacks. And the performances, by and large, are very good. I thought Rosamund Pike maybe laughed a little too much to say that she was a free spirit. That got a bit irritating.
Yeah, she's not in it that much.
She's not in it too much, but she packs a lot of laughing into scant screen time. It was okay. It kind of won me over gradually in kind of incremental degrees. But at the same time, it was a very sort of middle brow, slightly heavy, lethargic film.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I did enjoy the photography of Greece as well. I mean, it's sort of part Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
A little bit,
a
worryingly, yeah.
But I thought that the gruff Serbian actor.
Can you say his name? Is it Rade Shebazica? Is that right?
I can just say it as bad as well as you.
Okay, yeah. You have a go.
But Rade Shebazica.
Very good.
I think he's right. I think he's a really fine actor. I really like him.
Yeah.
He's popped up a few times.
Yeah, and he was, and him and Delane are both in their own way. Very unshowy actors who managed to communicate a lot with you know, very kind of nuanced motions and just a kind of little expression.
Yeah, I mean,
here
I think that's
there.
What the book's about. As you say, the book is elliptical and is very episodic and works in fragments. And that's very much about the silence, I think, that has existed between the kind of the events of the Holocaust and the kind of modern day, where people and fathers don't talk about it to their sons. And I thought that kind of taciturnity came across quite well in the film. But because it's so difficult to express on a film, it might be something to do with the film's stodginess, that there are these kind of great gaps of almost sort of not much happeningness. That said, as Holocaust, meditative Holocaust pieces in later life go, I think it was kind of an interesting contribution to that kind of genre. That's Fugitive Pieces. Next up, we've got Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell, played in an out-of-competition slot in Cannes. It stars Alison Lohman as a bank clerk who refuses a gypsy loan and is hexed thereafter.
Hi, I came to see Sylvia Ganesh. Is she here?
Who are you?
I'm a friend of hers. Someone...
Wait. I know who you are. Grandma told me you would come. You're the woman from the bank, the one who took her house.
Actually, it was the bank that took the house. I mean, I just worked there. In fact, I tried to help your grandma get the house back, but my boss wouldn't let me.
Are you going to stand here on my porch and lie to my face?
No.
You used to be a real fat girl, didn't you?
Yeah.
I can tell. You are not welcome here.
Wait. I need to see her. I need her to forgive me. And I'll get her the house back.
And you're going to make everything all right for her, is that it?
Yes.
Zan, I confess, I actually haven't seen Drag Me to Hell. The return of Sam Raimi to his horror roots thrill me.
Does it not? But you've taken the moral of this film. Never refuse a gypsy alone is the message that Raimi is giving us here. And this is his return to the sort of the Evil Dead style kind of.
I mean, I did like it. I mean, I quite liked Evil Dead.
Well, then you'll like this, and I urge you to go and see it.
Go on.
It's a lot of fun, really. It's like, I mean, you know, the cliche about these kind of films is that they take their lead from the old sort of DC horror comics of the 1950s, and it totally does. You can almost kind of see it storyboarded out. It's Alison Lohman as an ambitious loans officer who turns down this gypsy and gets a hex put on her, and all of a sudden she's sort of battling poltergeists and there's maggots and green slime, and then eventually a black goat will come and take her to hell.
This is a hell of a hex.
It's a hell of a hex. I mean, that was the alternative title for this film, I think.
Hex rated?
It's hexcellent, is what it is. And now, you know, in saying this plot, I'm my toes are slightly curling. That there's this, I'm sort of suddenly aware of how dodgy this plot sounds. It's very unreconstructed, isn't it? That, and the gypsy is, you know, the suggestion that gypsies are kind of evil and dirty of poor hygiene and are all ready to put a hex on you. And this film really does go for that.
Right.
So it's a little bit dubious as a concept.
Is it a set in America? It's an American
yeah,
set.
It, yes, right. It is, yeah. And there's a scene where the gypsy is, you know, a great performance by Lorna Raven as Mrs. Ganouche, who attempts to bite Alison Lohman while they're having their meeting about the mortgage, but she's taking.
Well, you're not going to get a loan if you're biting your loan.
No, this was after, this is after she's turned down. She thinks that the bite might, you know, sway Alison Lohman and to.
But in the current climate, Dan. I mean,
the current climate is this, and this is it. This is the credit crunch thing. But she tries to
munch.
She tries to bite, but she's taken her false teeth out, so she's kind of gumming on Alison Lohman. So there's a lot of slightly kind of scatological horror thrown
okay,
in there.
Okay, so people do like Sam Raimi. It was a big event, his return to horror, because as I say, he's been. I mean, I really liked his the sort of Bag of Money film he did, The Simple Plan.
Yeah,
with Billy Bob Thornton and Bill Paxton, really good. And then he went on to do Spider-Man and kind of stretched out into the big budget and kind of became a huge success. This presumably doesn't have half the budget that you know Spider-Man's little finger has.
Absolutely, although it does have a lot of you know. Standard horror movie special effects that totally work. I think it's something like a PG-13. So it's not going for the absolute gross-out horror of Evil Dead. But for a PG-13, it's pretty queasy at times.
Right, and is it... I mean, obviously one wants a horror to be scary. Were you scared?
I was... it's not
this
that
is not an
kind
admission of weakness, San. You can be scared.
I'm scared by so many films. I was terrified by Antichrist. this isn't overtly scary because it's kind of crash bang wallop and fun. It's like a kind of sort of roller coaster ride. Mm-hmm. It's not going for the real dark fear. And in that way, it works fine. It's diverting. It's entertaining.
I shall catch up with Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell because the return of a maestro to his former stomping ground is something to be marked in the world of cinema. If you do want to catch up with any of Zan's wonderful video contributions to the world of criticisms and to his reviews, do of
Some
course
falling off the dinghy as well. There.
I thought you kept your sea legs rather well, and and a nice hat as well to keep your little head.
I'm a star.
Yeah, you are a star in the making, Zan. You and Charlotte Gainsbourg as well. That's still up there on the Guardian site. Go to www.guardian.co.uk/film.
In our village was a signpost, hand-painted, made of wood. For years it gave directions, as on the bank it stood. But time moved on, and by us all, sadly got forgotten. Till the day it fell apart, damp, decayed and rotten. Along came the council men and dug a great big hole and put us up a modern one upon a big steel pole. Now there's a signpost at the junction at the bottom of our lane, a lovely, nice new modern one. But was it all in vain? 'Cause when the wind blows in the night, the pointers move around and Carmarthen's where come Simlog is. And Penryn can't be found. So now I look forward to the day it's old and rusted and replaced with a wooden one. At least it could be trusted.
That beautiful image of moving road signs is a particularly pertinent one in Gideon Koppel's debut feature documentary, Sleep Furiously. The film traces the life of a Welsh region called Trefoirig in Wales and abandons easy plotting and signposted narratives for a purely poetic evocation of people and place. The source of this insight is Gideon Koppel's own childhood memories, and he joins me now to tell us more about the source for the film, Sleep Furiously. Welcome to Film Weekly, Gideon. Congratulations on Sleep Furiously. It's a film that we don't see very often here in Britain, this sort of poetic evocation of the rhythms and pace of country life. There's obviously deeply ingrained within you and your psyche to come up with a film just like this.
It is ingrained in me in a certain way, but I think not as much as sometimes has been written about. My parents moved there when I was 13, and I think I had been going to that area on holiday since I was about 8.
There's a lot of pigs, there's a lot of sheep, there's a lot of cows. Obviously, the agricultural aspect of this region is key and crucial. It dominates their life. And I suppose they kind of live life according to the cycles of the animals here. Their lives are dictated by nature, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a phrase as I remember it, in Welsh, that translates that people people don't own the land, they belong to the land. And I really loved this idea of the permanence of the land, and that people are transient and life in a way is transient. And in a sense, it almost gives a kind of meaning to life on some level, that you're there as almost a kind of caretaker of this sort of world of nature. And I took that initial thought, and that became transferred in my mind, that the land and the landscape had to become a character within the film, and I needed to find ways of evoking a sense of character in the same way as some of the kind of personalities that you mentioned become characters, that the land, you know, is almost the protagonist of
absolutely
the film.
Well, there's a wonderful sequence. It starts off quite busy. There's a farmer and his tractor, and eventually the farmer and the tractor leave, the sheep then leave, and it's left with just the dog looking at the hills and a track, and then the dog eventually finally leaves the frame, and we're just left with the green empty hills. I mean, it's just a beautiful kind of, you know, assertion of what dominates there, as you've explained. There's also a wonderful sequence of a choir, who you only show the conductor of the choir, a woman who's conducting this beautiful choir. I don't know, it's almost spiritual in its transcendence.
I'd been invited to film a rehearsal of the choir, and it took place in a secondary school that was slightly outside of the actual kind of boundaries of the community, a secondary school in Aberystwyth. And it was a very ugly room. And I knew that what I really wanted to do was to record the singing. So the first thing was to establish the way in which we recorded the sound. So there are always these kind of choices with filming. When you're working with very limited resources, the choices are much clearer. Mm-hmm. And there's something really wonderful about that. So the first simple choice is, do we put a microphone on the choir leader and then record the choir in mono, or do we forget what the choir leader says and just record the sound of the singing? And it was very clear to me that we used two microphones to create the biggest stereo picture of the choir singing. And then the next thing is, for me, once I'd sorted out what was happening with the sound, is to think about what I wanted to see. And what I was interested in was the choir leader. I think her dedication and involvement in the choir, which is, for all of these people, it's a hobby. It's a, yeah, an amateur activity, and yet the passion that goes behind it is fantastic. And for me, it was very clear the most interesting visual element in that room was her face.
What did the people of Trefoil make of the film? Have you shown it there? Did you sit them all down, get a, not cast and crew, but a cast screening there? And
yeah, there was a screening at the Aberystwyth Arts Centre. In fact, it was on for 6 nights there. The first night it was half full, and the remaining nights it sold out. And I think it's, I don't know, something like 250-seater cinema, which in a way maybe kind of says enough. It's very difficult. It's very, in that I could sort of be sentimental about it and sort of say, you know, everybody loved it and da-da-da-da. And my guess is that the appreciation of it is very different from different people. And there was somebody... I remember one of the screenings, I was there and somebody came out of the screening at the end and looked at me and said, "Oh, I didn't know that you were making a poem." And I was very touched by that.
Yeah, one thinks when looking at sort of poetic evocations of the Welsh countryside, one can't help but think of Dylan Thomas and Chlarigub and Undermilk Wood. Was that an influence at all on your work or in the edit at any stage? Did you think of it?
All the time. I mean, I remember seeing Under Milkwood performed, I think, as a school play when I was probably about 10 or 11. It had a big, big impact on me and made me laugh a lot. And so, yes, it's stayed with me. And I have the Richard Burton version of it on my iPod, and so from time to time I kind of dip into bits of it.
Yeah, beautiful. My... Gideon Koppel, thanks very much for coming on Film Weekly. Gideon Koppel's Sleep Furiously is released across the UK on Friday the 29th of May. Well, that's all for this week. Thanks to my guest Gideon Koppel and to Idris Elba. Do join me on Facebook, as we love to hear your penny's worth on all the films we review and feature here on Film Weekly. Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for the trailer trash column from me, of course, and the best film reviews and news. The soundtrack music we've been featuring on this week's show is from Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell. It's composed by master of the horror score, Christopher Young. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.